Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, it's been 50 years since one of the most famous shipwrecks on the Great Lakes, the Edmund Fitzgerald, went down in a storm in November 1975. We'll hear from the author of a new book about the sinking. The Voice of America was created in the World War II era, and since then it's reported news for a foreign audience, playing a key role in spreading democracy. But this year, the Trump administration shut it down. We'll talk with the VOA's former White House bureau chief about that decision. A group of kids who were on the forefront of desegregation in one Illinois school district discuss what happened and how they remain friends to this day. And we'll also travel to a community along the Mississippi River, where dealing with flooding is just part of life. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. When it launched in 1958, the Edmund Fitzgerald was the largest freighter on the Great Lakes. But on November 10, 1975, the massive ship went down in Lake Superior during a wild storm. All 29 of the crew members died. Now, 50 years later, there are still questions about what happened in the final hours before the sinking. The history of the Edmund Fitzgerald, the lives of the men who served on the ship, and the repercussions of that final voyage are the subject of the new book, The Gales of November. The author is John U. Bacon, and he spoke with Doug Tribou.
Your book includes a lot of great history and context about the region, the Great Lakes, the shipping industry, and how the stage was set for the Edmund Fitzgerald to become sort of a celebrity, record-breaking freighter. Would you explain, though, how the fresh water of the Great Lakes creates challenges and dangers that ship captains don't encounter in the salt water of oceans?
Well, I grew up on the Great Lakes, and yet a lot of this was surprising to me. Experienced sailors, commercial sailors, will tell you that the Great Lakes are more dangerous than the Atlantic Ocean, which seems impossible. But here's why. One reason is the salt water mutes the waves on the ocean. So they're not pointy. They're like big roller coasters. Spreads them out. They're twice as far apart as they are on the Great Lakes. The fresh water makes pointy waves like a mountain range, which means you can have the bow of a ship like the Edmund Fitzgerald in one wave, 30-footer, and then nothing in the middle, and then your stern in another wave, 30 feet high, which means it's going to crack in the middle. That's one of the theories about the Edmund Fitzgerald.
And then the freezing of the water in storms is also a factor because fresh water freezes more easily.
Far more easily, and it weighs down the ship by hundreds of tons. It's just crazy. And can make it tilt to a side, and now you're having a real problem.
The name Edmund Fitzgerald is so associated with the ship and its ultimate demise that I was surprised to learn from your book that the freighter was named not for some historical figure, but for someone who was very much alive when the freighter was built. In fact, it was his idea. Who was Edmund Fitzgerald?
He was the CEO of Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance, still a gigantic concern in Milwaukee. They insured the shipping business. They insured the mines that produced the iron that the ships would carry. But also his five great uncles were all captains. And his dad is one of the greatest shipbuilders in the Great Lakes.
The Fitz, as it was often called, stood out in a lot of ways, from the engineering that went into its design to a set of luxury accommodations on board. Tell us about some of the things that made it unusual for its time.
For one thing, it was the biggest on the Great Lakes. It's 729 feet, carried the biggest loads, and also one of the fastest ships on the Great Lakes. It was also the most luxurious, as you said, which seems oxymoronic. This is an iron ore carrier. But the cabins, the kitchen were all first in class. This was to attract the best crew in the Great Lakes, and they did. And the VIP quarters, which they had for their clients, the guys paying for all these services, two staterooms with air conditioning, plush carpeting, color TVs. None of these were common in hotels at the time.
Right.
And why is that? To make sure the money keeps coming in.
As you note in the Gales of November, watching Great Lakes shipping freighters is a bit of a spectator sport. There's a two-story viewing gallery alongside the Sioux Locks in Sioux St. Marie in the Upper Peninsula. Highly recommended. It's really fun. I've been there with my family to do it. And the Edmund Fitzgerald developed a following right from the start. How big was its launch party in Detroit in June of 1958?
They launched in Detroit because that's where the ship was built. 15,000 people came out in the middle of the day, a work day, to celebrate the launch of the ship. they outdrew the Detroit Tigers.
The Edmund Fitzgerald quickly started setting Great Lakes records for the amount of cargo it was hauling, as you mentioned. What were the most common things for the freighter to be hauling, and what was a typical route?
Almost always, this ship would carry pelletized iron, 500 million pellets per ship. That's enough to build 7,000 cars, and they would do this once a week. They'd go from Duluth, more or less, to Detroit or Toledo, and then go back. It was called the Toledo Express for that reason, and they did that trip 50 times a year.
The Fitz's final captain was Ernest McSorley, who took over in the 1972 season, a few years before the sinking. What was McSorley like, and how did he run the ship?
The short story, he was the greatest captain on the Great Lakes, and I've got current sailors who sailed with him, against him, and so on, all saying the same thing. One guy said, I saw that man park 729 feet of steel between two ships with 3 feet on either side, as though he's parallel parking his F-150 pickup truck. He was the best in rough weather, they all said. He's also the most aggressive in terms of never turning around, going through horrible weather. Your strength is your weakness, of course. But also, he's a fundamentally decent guy who was so loyal to his people, and they were so loyal to him, that they would follow him from ship to ship. They loved that man.
So let's talk about that final run in 1975. The Edmund Fitzgerald set off from Wisconsin on November 9th, fully loaded, and Captain Ernest McSorley chose to take what is known as the northern route across Lake Superior, turning south as it got close to the Big Lake's eastern shore. The captain of another freighter, the Arthur Anderson, did the same that day. What was the early part of that run like, and what were the problems both ships encountered?
Well, Sunday, November 9th, was 70 degrees in Duluth. There's a storm coming in from Alberta, Canada, bringing cold, dry air. There's also another storm coming up from the southwest of the United States, bringing hot, wet air. It's all going to collide over Lake Superior, right in front of Whitefish Bay, and McSorley always went straight shot across the lake, but this time he decides to be cautious. But it's going to add 14 hours to the trip. That gives the storm 14 hours to get there first, and now you're in unfamiliar waters.
The Arthur Anderson, the other freighter, was about 10 miles behind the Fitz when it got the last communication from Captain McSorley. There had been some understated calls from McSorley to the Anderson over a period of hours, but no specific mayday call at the end. And one of the most remarkable things to me that comes through in your book is how little we actually know about those final moments for this massive freighter on a well-traveled route.
And that's why I don't try to quite solve the mystery that happened. I certainly promote some theories versus others based on new evidence that I've dug up and others have as well. But the best quote on that comes from Ruth Hudson. She's the mother of Bruce Hudson, her only child, who's on the ship as a deckhand, 22 years old. She said, only 30 know. 29 men and God, and no one's talking. So without witnesses, we're left to guess.
And there are heartbreaking stories of crew members who were planning to retire after the run. And I want to note here that you do a wonderful job of sharing some details about them and their time on the Fitz. There was a man who never got to meet his unborn child, and a child, of course, that never knew his father. And during this interview, we don't have enough time to do justice to all those moments, but I would like you to share the story of Eddie Bindon and what he did during his last couple of days on shore before his final voyage.
Eddie Bindon was a veteran of 25 years. He was the first assistant engineer on the ship. He bought his wife a 25th anniversary ring in Duluth, Minnesota, right across from Superior, Wisconsin, where the ship was docked, and gave it to a friend to give to her. And why he did this, only Eddie Bindon could know, because he's going to be home in Toledo, near his home in Ohio, 3 days later. Of course, the ship goes down. And then about a week later, Ms. Bindon received a 25th anniversary diamond ring in the mail from her husband.
Now, 50 years later, if you talk with people about the Edmund Fitzgerald, especially with people who aren't old enough to remember the incident itself, people often mention the song The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald by Gordon Lightfoot as the way they got to know a little bit about the story. And you write that Lightfoot was really torn about releasing what he'd written, and then the families had very mixed reactions when it came out. How did all of that play out?
Sure. Well, he's a sailor. He knows the Great Lakes, cares about them. He had a melody in his head, an old Irish sea dirge, basically. but no words. And then the articles came in, and he realized, okay, this is what I need to write about. So he writes the song, but he does not want to record it. He's very sensitive about this and very self-conscious. And finally, they're recording in Toronto, but they're not going to record this song. And finally, they finish the album with a day and a half left. And the studio producer says, look, dude, I'm charging you whether you play the song or not. The guys in the band had never heard the song before.
Hmm.
And when they finished the song, they said that wasn't half bad. And then they said, let's try it again. Not as good. They come back the next day, try it 4 or 5 more times. Not as good. The song you hear on the radio is the first time the band ever played it.
Hmm.
And that never, ever happens.
Right.
It's what they're feeling. And it should be noted, even the families who were not sure about that song at first became huge believers in Gordon Lightfoot himself and the song.
Well, John, as you note, the Edmund Fitzgerald's one of the many ships to go down on the Great Lakes. And there had been some other significant and deadly wrecks in the late 50s and the 60s, and some of them also on the final run of the season in November in a major storm. Lots of similarities. Did the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald lead to any safety changes?
The Edmund Fitzgerald changed the entire industry. Like I said before, there are 6,000 shipwrecks between 1875 and 1975. There has not been one since. So 6,000, one per week for a century, right? And none for half a century. Why? Like one of my experts told me, when do you fix anything? When it's broken. So this got so much attention, Titanic going down, basically, that they finally fixed forecasting for good. They fixed communications with the captains. And also, third, common sense. All right, they simply do not go out in that kind of weather anymore. They used to all the time.
That's the author John U. Bacon. His new book, The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald, is out now. The wreck of the freighter on the Great Lakes happened 50 years ago, November 10th, 1975.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy.
Few schools budged in the decade after the Supreme Court overturned racial segregation in public schools with the Brown v. Board of Education decision in 1954. It took years for new laws, court cases, and federal funding incentives to push districts to change. But in Urbana, a group of determined parents convinced the district to voluntarily desegregate. And 59 years later, many students from that first integrated class are still friends. Emily Hayes has the story.
Angela Patterson and Laura Hastings greet each other with nicknames from their childhood before I even start recording. I have to ask them to repeat what they said.
Go ahead, Angie.
Okay. I said, I'm Angie Burnett, and I got a big boot.
I'm Laura Lollipop. Yeah, man.
Then they're off, telling stories without any need for my questions.
Was it at camp and we had to do an introduction, so we went through and figured out different things that we wanted to say. And at the time, we talked about boots, and they're not like boots like that you wear, but like the back of your head is like a boot.
Both were kindergartners in 1966 when the Ellis Drive 6 parents pushed Urbana to integrate its elementary schools. The district already had integrated middle and high schools. But this group of parents saw almost no Black students were graduating from high school. They thought their children weren't being prepared adequately in their neighborhood elementary school. Angela's mom was one of the Ellis Drive 6, and Angela became one of the first Black students to attend Yankee Ridge Elementary. Laura, who is white, transferred there in fifth grade, and she recalls first meeting Angela on the playground.
Angie, I just remember that you were fast and you talked a lot. And I'm like, I'm going to like her because she talks a lot like I do.
Their friendship strengthened over time. They went to camp together. They also did cheerleading and grew up as teenagers.
Remember, we'd go up on campus and we were supposed to do that. And somebody would see that my parents' blue station wagon and say, did you go to a movie? And then they knew I was busted. We were not supposed to be on campus. Here we were in our little letter jackets, right? Walking around.
Yeah.
While Laura and Angela had a somewhat rosy experience with integration, others weren't so lucky. Angela stayed at her neighborhood elementary for kindergarten for an extra year while her brothers transferred. She learned later that delay shielded her. One of her brothers was screamed at by white parents at Yankee Ridge.
I heard my brother talking about it on a radio program when he was talking about how they were screamed at. And I told him, I don't remember that. He said, you didn't go the first year.
She only remembers good things at the school, except for one teacher. At the time, she loved her.
When I tell you I adored my teacher, I knew her daughter was a cheerleader. I knew she was from Texas. I loved her. I thought she was wonderful. I still remember her name. Not going to say it.
But for Angela, first grade was too easy. She was bored and acting out in class. Her parents told the school she needed to be put in a more advanced class. When the school finally did assess her, she breezed through all the test books. But her teacher was unhappy to see her join the upper level track.
She threw my books at me. She threw them. I'm a first grader. She threw those books at me. And I was like, okay, it really was kind of a painful experience.
She still thinks about it when she interviews teachers for her church's Sunday school in Georgia.
Not everybody's cup of tea, but a child should never know that you don't favor them.
After college, Laura and Angela's families kept running into each other. Laura became a teacher in town and ended up teaching Angela's niece.
You know, my brother was a little circumspect about, because I think she was in special ed class or something, a little circumspect about the school until he saw Laura. And he was like, all right, we're going to be okay because we got Laura.
Angela lives in Georgia now, but the two are still close. Now, the data shows many schools across the country have become as segregated as they were in the late 60s, especially for low-income Black and Hispanic students. I asked them if they think states and school districts should try again. Laura says in order to grow, you need to be around people who are different from you.
Just so we all get along in the world, that we know about other people, but learn about other people firsthand. You can't learn it from a book. You can't. You have to have the exposure and have the opportunities, kind of like we had socially, outside of school and inside school.
Angela, for her part, says she's not sure whether the integration effort did all it set out to do.
Part of the reason why things may have maybe not have gone as planned is because there was an initial plan and then there were compromises that had to be made. The initial plan of integration was that they wanted Black teachers to go first. I think they wanted, but the kids went first.
But she says her experience gave her the confidence to walk into every room as an equal, and it gave her great friends. I'm Emily Hayes.
More ahead on Statewide in just a moment. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A bid to crack down on steep homeowners' insurance price hikes went down in the Illinois House recently. Under that bill, opposed by the insurance industry, companies like State Farm would have had to notify customers within 60 days of premium increases of at least 10%. Supporters say it would have given people time to shop around, but Republican State Representative Jeff Kiker was opposed.
That would interfere with the free market and damage the rates that the consumers pay and make them artificially high because of the regulation.
Several Democrats voted against the bill. State Farm earlier this year raised homeowner premiums an average of 27%. Governor J.B. Pritzker condemned that move. His administration backed an earlier version of this plan. Today we have a conversation with Steve Herman, a longtime journalist who spent about 20 years with Voice of America, including as White House Bureau Chief and Chief National Correspondent. Voice of America was in the spotlight this year as the Trump administration effectively shut it down. Herman will be speaking in Springfield Wednesday, November 12th, part of the World Affairs Council of Central Illinois program. We talked to Steve Herman about his career and journalism. Let me just start by having you explain a little bit about Voice of America. What is it, or what, I guess maybe a better term, what was it?
Yeah, Sean, it's a great question because the state of the Voice of America, which was on the air uninterrupted for 83 years until the middle of March this year, is really in limbo at best. I would say it's in a deep coma, if not dead, because of the actions the current administration has taken against this U.S. government-funded broadcaster. The Voice of America, when it went off the air in mid-March, was broadcasting in 49 languages to several hundred million people on television, radio, online. There was also distribution via social media apps. And if you've not heard of the Voice of America inside the United States, that's not really surprising. The Voice of America was and always was intended to be an external broadcasting service. What that meant is we told the world what was going on in the United States, but the broadcasts were not targeted at nor intended for the American public. It was a part of America's public diplomacy.
A lot of the broadcasting that was done, a lot of the news that was generated and produced and then sent out, it was part of America's larger foreign policy. Wouldn't that be a way to say it?
Oh, absolutely. But it was unique in the sense that it was not a propaganda service. From the day that the Voice of America went on the air in 1942 in German, that was the first language, the announcer said, whether the news is good or bad, we're going to tell you the truth, which was a bit of a novelty at the time for international broadcasters. You could be in Illinois, turn on your radio in the late 1930s, and hear broadcasts from Nazi Germany coming into your living room. And it was propaganda. They were telling you how great the German socialist system was, and when the war started, how they were winning every battle. And VOA was unique in the sense that we would be a projection of American values, including freedom of the press and objectivity in our reporting. And that was mandated by law in latter decades during the Ford administration. Congress passed laws which ensured the autonomy of the Voice of America, even though it was government funded, that it would reflect American thought and institution, which meant if there was a particular issue we were reporting about, say abortion or flag burning, it wasn't the projection of whatever the administration's stance was on that particular issue at that particular time. We were objective. We would go out, just as you would, and interview people on both sides of the story and also explain to people who were in Zimbabwe or Burma or North Korea the background, the context of what this issue was about.
So from the World War II era all the way till today, different presidents, of course, different administrations, some more progressive, some more right-leaning. Voice of America has continued and continued to thrive during that period. What has happened more recently?
In the middle of March, a combination of Carrie Lake, who proclaimed that she was now in charge of the parent agency of the Voice of America, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, even though she was not put into that role by Congress, as is mandated. She, along with the forces of DOGE, which for a time was headed by billionaire Elon Musk, shut it down. And the president literally said, shut it down, alleging that the Voice of America was woke and liberal and all that sort of stuff with absolutely no evidence. Obviously, because they wanted to turn the Voice of America into a propaganda instrument, which it is not allowed to be. And the journalists at Voice of America, such as myself, I was there for about 20 years, we could not do that, even if we were ordered to by the president or the Secretary of State to twist or spin our journalism because of these laws, a statutory firewall, which mandated that there would be free and fair coverage. And it's very unfortunate, obviously, what has happened. Hundreds of millions of people have lost access to free information in places where there's really no alternative, like in North Korea. VOA was a primary source, if not the source, of outside and factual objective information for these people.
So now that VOA is not producing the way it did, what is happening as far as in these other countries? Are they getting information from other places? Has somebody stepped into that void?
Yeah, Sean, in some cases, we know that as far as the radio frequencies and the satellite transponders and our affiliate relationships with television and radio stations around the world, that the Chinese and Russians are trying to fill that void. But in most cases, there's just no way. Take North Korea, for example, because the South Koreans have also cut off their external broadcast to North Korea. All they have now is the state propaganda. And in a totalitarian country, you can imagine what that is like. So we've shot ourselves in the foot because the Voice of America over the decades was extremely valuable for giving people a positive image about the United States. I'd like to say that the Berlin Wall did not come down because NATO tanks rolled through it. but because jazz music on The Voice of America wafted over the Berlin Wall.
I hosted a panel discussion just recently here on our campus. It was titled The First Amendment Under Stress. And I guess I would ask you, is the First Amendment under stress?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about it because of the overt and otherwise not so subtle intimations made by people like the President of the United States, the Commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission. And I think we can say what has happened to the Voice of America and the cutting of funding to the other U.S. government-backed broadcasters such as Radio Free Europe and Radio Free Asia. They're effectively have been shut down because their funding has been cut off, although Congress mandated that that money be spent. This is a kind of canary in the coal mine, and you combine that with the killing of the funds for the Corporation of Public Broadcasting, which, of course, benefited NPR and PBS. These are a low-hanging fruit for the administration. They have direct or indirect control over part or all of the budgets for these particular broadcasters. And that has a chilling effect. It sends a warning to others, and we have seen that happening with the big owners of commercial networks by putting in different staff to run news operations or temporarily pulling particular talk show hosts off the air or currying favor with the administration because they want to have their mergers approved, those sort of things. This all leads definitely, Sean, to the First Amendment being under threat.
We're talking with Steve Herman, an educator, journalist, and author. He also spent a long time with Voice of America and was their White House bureau chief and chief national correspondent. He's going to be speaking in Springfield. When I think of Voice of America or the CPB, we mentioned that, maybe these are done for good. There could be a change of heart at some point. There could be some funding that's put in place. But CPB is one thing. Voice of America, a completely different one. It seems as though the longer this is not producing what it has in the past, the more you risk losing that audience overseas.
Oh, Sean, I think those audiences are gone. You know, they're not tuning back in every day on the radio or on TV looking to see, oh, is the Voice of America back today? Because it's been off the air now for about 8 months. They quickly changed their habits. We do know, for example, that people were very concerned about what happened because there was no explanation. Some of our viewers and listeners in places like West Africa, we know we're trying to get a hold of some of our reporters wondering what had happened because the TV had gone to static or the radio was playing music loops with no programming. Some of them actually thought perhaps there had been a coup in the United States.
You're also the author of a book called Behind the White House Curtain, a senior journalist's story of covering the president and why it matters. So I wanted to talk about that for a moment.
Well, what I wanted to do with this book, I realized that there had been a lot of books written by White House correspondents who gave you some inside information on big stories that probably they should have revealed as reporters, not held it to write a book. But I saw that there were very few books who took you through in granular detail about what it's like to cover the White House. When I would go out and make public appearances, like the one I'm going to be doing in Springfield, whatever I talked about, people would always come up and ask me, well, what was it like to ask the president questions every day? What is he really like? You know, in recent years, they would say, is Trump crazy or is Biden senile? You know, those sort of questions. And what is it like to write on Air Force One? What do you actually do? And as a Voice of America a reporter at the White House, I was part of what's called the press pool system, this rotational group of reporters that actually goes into the Oval Office or travels with the president on Air Force One on behalf of the rest of the media, because you can't fit 150 reporters on Air Force One, or you can't get that many people into the Oval Office. So in a sense, we take turns and then relay that information to all the other reporters. But also what I wanted to do was to put it in historical context. You know, we're very fortunate in the United States, Sean, where we get to ask our leaders, or those of us who are covering the leader of the country, to ask them questions directly, or to travel with them on overseas trips. And by the way, the reporters, news organizations pay for those seats on Air Force One. They're not freebies. This is rare. Even in some of the world's leading democracies, I don't think Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, since he's been in power, has done one interview with an Indian news organization. So it is a real luxury. I wanted to explain it, but it is a relatively modern evolution. For most of American history, when reporters were allowed to speak to the president, this all kind of started with Abe Lincoln answering questions. They weren't usually allowed to quote the president directly on the record, so to speak. It was off the record or on background. And the type of thing that we take for granted now, live news conferences by the president, that is a relatively recent innovation.
Having that access to the president, I know there will be people who say, well, then how did we not see or hear more, at least, about what was happening with Joe Biden, that he may have been declining? And the media, we didn't see a whole lot about that in daily reporting. Can you address that?
Yeah, I did talk a little bit about this in my book, which was obviously written very early on in the Biden administration. And I was only dealing with Joe Biden on a day-to-day basis for the first year of his presidency. So after that, I was only occasionally in the room with him. And what I observed with Biden is he did seem to get tired at the end of the day, and then his language became a little bit disjointed, perhaps nothing too unusual for somebody his age. And I also sort of detected that Biden, who had a very serious stuttering problem when he was a child and had really overcome that, when he would get tired, I think he had a difficulty articulating very well. But I've got to tell you, with the same situation with Donald Trump, because I was always asked, about Trump's mental faculties. You know, we can observe and report and relay and inquire, but we are not medical professionals. It would be kind of derelict of duty for us to make, some sort of statement about the president's health. But we do know throughout American history, and I detail this in the book with especially some egregious cases with some of the presidents, that medical conditions of the presidents were covered up. But that's one of the reasons that we want to see the president almost every day and talk to him to help demonstrate, what kind of condition that the president is in. And if you've seen it recently, if Donald Trump is not seen in public or doesn't talk to the press for a few days, all sorts of rumors start to swirl.
Well, just about a minute left here, Steve, but I did want to ask you, as somebody who's seen these attacks on journalism firsthand, your thoughts on the future of journalism. It seems as though a lot of younger folks may be questioning if this is an industry they want to go into, but what's your thoughts about it?
Well, I think journalism's always been a tough job. It's always been a demanding job. It's not a popularity contest. If you are asking tough questions and you're reporting objectively, people are not going to like it, especially in this age of where everything seems to be what we call confirmation bias. People just want to have their own preset views validated from their information sources, which is, I think is dangerous. We should be hearing from other voices, at least to know what other people are saying and thinking. But I would encourage young people to pursue this very noble and important profession, especially at times where it is under assault. We need to be brave. We need to stand up to authority and call into question authority. Again, this is not a partisan position. When I would do a lot of my stories, people both on the left and the right would get upset with the same story because I wasn't adhering to what they thought should be their particular point of view. But good journalism is not opinion writing. It is factual, and hopefully it is thoughtful.
Steve Herman, a longtime journalist, formerly with Voice of America. He'll be speaking in Springfield Wednesday, November 12th at the Illini Country Club, part of the World Affairs Council of Central Illinois program. We'll be back with more of Statewide in just a moment. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Four times a year, public radio stations in Illinois air a show called Prison Cast that serves people in Illinois prisons and jails. That show receives hundreds of messages from incarcerated people, many saying they're working to better themselves while they do time. But there are barriers to that, some of which are only skin deep. Prison Cast producer Lauren Frost takes us to Canton, Illinois, for a report on how tattoo removal programs could help people in custody get a fresh start.
Like lots of stories I report on, this one starts with a letter I got from inside prison.
Dear Prison Cast, the reason for me writing and reaching out was I was trying to get a bill started in my name that will benefit every incarcerated man and woman that's faced with the same problem I'm dealing with.
This is Adonis Veal. He's incarcerated at Illinois River Correctional Center, a prison in central Illinois. And that problem he's dealing with, his face is covered in tattoos.
I think my teardrops was my first tattoo.
Some gang-related stuff.
Then I got the 6.G.
One is a hate symbol, though he says that's not why he got it. Adonis says ever since he began serving his sentence, he's wanted to take them all off.
I want to change my circle, my crowd, and I just wanted to change my appearance because it's like I don't want to be 60, 70 years old with tattoos in my face.
But here's the issue. He has no way to remove them or cover them while he's in the custody of the Illinois Department of Corrections.
I think that if guys could take advantage of that opportunity, they would.
That's where his idea comes in, for a state law to establish a tattoo removal program for incarcerated people. We wanted to investigate whether that's been done before and what it might look like. And it turns out, it's not such a wild idea. Last spring, I paid a visit to Redemption Studio. It's a state-licensed tattoo parlor, and it's inside the DuPage County Jail in Wheaton, Illinois.
Well, this is a fully functional tattoo studio. We got everything we need here.
This is Nick Perry, an artist with Empire Tattoos. When I visit, he's working with a client named Matthew, who's been getting some gang tattoos removed and covered.
At first, it's kind of difficult because you've had them for a long time. They become a part of you.
But Matthew says his mind changed as he got older. He's got three grandkids now.
If you take a realistic look at your life, the decision doesn't only affect me. It affects my family. I've been out in public with my mother and ran into some trouble because of my tattoos. So as I got older, it's a lot easier to make the decision.
The artists and technicians who visit Redemption Studio don't just hide gang tattoos or hate symbols. They'll cover branding marks from human trafficking, scars from bullet wounds or self-harm, anything that might make it hard for someone to move forward. Another client, Nicholas, says his old ink represents his old identity. He thinks he got his first tattoos when he was 13 or 14 years old.
I knew that if I was going to transition into this new life that I had pictured for myself, I knew that things have to be removed. And you have to kill that old identity that you had, you know, shaped for yourself.
This is just one program at one county-run jail. The Illinois Department of Public Health says it's not aware of any other body art studios in the state that are inside prisons or jails. But traveling studios are another option. California's Department of Corrections launched a statewide tattoo removal program in 2023. Associate Warden Melanie Bruns says they work with a contractor who drives mobile studios to all the different state prisons there.
I would highly encourage other Department of Corrections to consider this. The feedback that we've gotten from our population has been nothing but positive. I mean, we have wait lists at almost all of our institutions.
The Illinois Department of Corrections denied our request for an interview about whether it's considered a tattoo removal program here and did not respond to written questions by our deadline. Back at Illinois River Prison, Adonis hopes legislators will consider his pitch for what he's calling the Adonis L. Veal Tattoo Removal Act. In the meantime, he's finding other ways to reinvent himself, despite the dehumanizing conditions of a state prison.
I'm like 60% better than what I was coming in. I think the other 40% will be when I hit the gate and practice everything that I learned behind these prison walls.
Adonis says he's educating himself, working, reading, and trying to make the most of his time. I'm Lauren Frost.
Now let's go to a rural peninsula along the Mississippi River in southern Illinois. It's called Dogtooth Bend, and it's shaped a little like a sock and sets in the Big S curve in the river. It's where Chris Bentley found chronic flooding that has forced many farmers to give up their land and reflect on what it means to live with the river.
If you're looking for a visual reminder of just how powerful the Mississippi River is, consider the barges marooned in Dogtooth Bend.
Have you ever been on a barge before?
No, and definitely not on the land.
Yeah, I'd say that'd be a new one. I would hope so.
Adam Thomas and I trudged toward two barges, humongous steel boxes, each big enough to carry more than 1,000 tons of cargo. They should be in the river. Now they've got soybeans planted around them. In 2016, the river punched a hole in the levee near Thomas's farm. It was never repaired. When the water rose again in 2019, it carried 6 barges through the breach and plopped them on this farmland. 2 of them are still here.
And it's going to be a small hole to fit through. But
we climb up the barge's ladder to get a better view of their cavernous interiors.
We thought about making basketball courts at one time, as big as this thing is.
You can hear it echoing.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that something? I think the last thing they hauled, it looked like it was coal. There's a little bit left in the bottoms and stuff, but
from the top of this rusted-out barge, we can see the gap in the levee.
You know, this isn't a creek or a stream or anything. This is a river. This is a real river. We nickname it the Gray Monster. So
the Gray Monster.
Get ready, boys. The Gray Monster's coming. So it's getting ready to crawl out of its banks.
And it did exactly that in 2016 when it broke through the Len Small levee, which we're looking at the remnants of.
Yes.
About a mile away.
See that flag right there? There's a boat getting ready to come down.
That levee breach is a reminder that Dogtooth Bend is going to flood again. 2016 wasn't the first time this levee failed. There were breaches in 1993 and 2011. But after the last time, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said fixing the levee wouldn't be worth the cost. Farmers in the area couldn't raise the millions of dollars it would cost to rebuild it themselves, so a chunk of this land has effectively been ceded back to the river's floodplain. That left many people here with an impossible choice. Keep farming, at least until the next flood, or walk away from land that's been in their family for generations and give it back to nature.
It's sad. I remember when all this was excellent farm ground, the best of the best. You know, and to see it, you know, slowly dissipate and disappear, it's kind of heartbreaking. Now, there are some places on here that you'll never repair. Out of the 15,000 acres of tillable farm ground in Dogtooth Bend, 4,000 acres were gone, completely destroyed.
Thomas, a third-generation farmer, is sticking it out in Dogtooth Bend, but he is not expecting his sons to do the same. This part of the river is what hydrologists call an avulsion zone. It's where the Mississippi wants to change its course. The river was meandering and flooding long before Dogtooth Bend was farmland. A nature preserve called Horseshoe Lake hints at what this area used to look like, a cypress swamp teeming with birds and bullfrogs. It feels primordial next to the farms down the road. And since the 2019 flood, some of that farmland has returned to an earlier state as well. Theron Hobson climbs a windswept dune that would look more at home in the Sahara than southern Illinois. There's an abandoned machine shed in the distance, but nothing else to suggest this was productive farmland just a few years ago.
Underneath here somewhere used to be farmland, yep.
And now?
Now it's a lot of sand. We're standing on about a 10-foot tall sand berm and looking out across acres and acres of sand.
Hobson is with the Nature Conservancy, which owns some of the land that's been smothered by river bottom sand. They came in after the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service offered to compensate people whose land had been ruined, as long as they agreed not to farm it again. And while that land might not be good for growing crops anymore, it has become a haven for wildlife. Hobson is trudging through a mucky pond to try to find tadpoles of threatened Illinois chorus frogs.
These are little fish.
When it overflows, the river makes temporary wetlands that Hobson calls floodles.
Yeah, this is an area that was part of a scour, and as part of the restoration plan here, we had some heavy equipment come in and deepen that by about a foot to assure that it would be an ephemeral wetland in the spring when the chorus frogs are looking for that type of habitat.
Hobson has had his own struggles with flooding elsewhere in Illinois.
After repeated flooding, it kind of scared me off, so I ended up moving to the hills, where I was still close to the river, because, you know, growing up on a large floodplain river, you have an affinity for it. I mean, you spend a lot of time boating, fishing, hunting, and you love the river, but then sometimes you just have to get out of its way.
When you get out of its way, it doesn't take long for the river to reclaim what it's lost. Molly Sabatka monitors water quality in the Mississippi for the Missouri Department of Conservation. Where there used to be a levee, she finds a flock of black terns diving for fish. Sabatka says the river is a migratory path for birds and fish who seek out little side channels like the area behind the levee breach, even though it might not look like much more than a scraggly inlet.
The river is so important to so many different species because it connects them to other places like this 100 miles away or 1,000 miles away. The river is the pathway between all these different habitats.
A migratory swimway, she calls it, for species like paddlefish and bigmouth buffalo. Sabatka says it's encouraging to see so much nature return so quickly.
We can see from this, you know, animals responding here, you know, within a year, speaks to how when you do those things, it's going to happen for those animals very quickly. How did they find it? I don't know. But they do, yeah.
Some animals can adapt pretty quickly. But what about the people forced to get out of the river's way? People like Elaine Bonifield.
Come on in.
Bonifield is 81 years old. She says she had to do some soul searching before accepting an offer from the USDA and the Nature Conservancy that took her family's farmland out of production. Her family has owned land in the area going back to the 19th century. But she says flooding made it impossible to keep farming.
Our planet is changing. I'm not one of these eco-environment nuts who think tomorrow you're going to wake up and the planet will be untenable because climate has changed overnight. But we have known all of our lifetimes that the planet was changing. Rivers have been changing all that time, too. And I'm sad that we had to sell the ground that was in our family's name. It's sad to pass it on and to think about your family's little link in this necklace of history that pertains to that particular piece of ground. But I guess before that, some Indian chieftain claimed this part of the world. What makes you think that it isn't going to change and go on again, you know? So now it'll become government land. And I can accept that. I don't like it. But I can't turn back time. Life is crazy. You may think today you know what's best, but the whole environment can change around you.
If there's one thing that's constant through all that change, it's that everything depends on the river. Despite that lingering sadness of losing that link to her family's history, Bonifield says she's happy her land has a new heritage, one with a little more room for nature. And she likes visiting the mergansers that dive for crayfish on her former farm.
And I like it that they're not afraid when you go down there. But when the water is running across that road in our field, a gravel road which we put there, I get every crawdad that's loose, I think, bottoms up all the way across. They're cute. And they can raise their young, grow old, come back year after year, and it works. And I like that about it. It's self-perpetuating. And that's the piece I would hate to lose.
Nature may be self-perpetuating, but it could be harder for people than ducks to accept the new reality of the river. I'm Chris Bentley.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us, and join us next time for reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.